The automobile has always been more than just a means of transportation for many people, often a sign of independence, power, individualism, and control. It's why it's so difficult for people who must confront the day when they are no longer competent to drive to relinquish their car keys. What system of evaluation should be in place to ensure public safety and balance the needs of the driver? The question is multifaceted and covers issues pertaining to driver skill and experience, the effects of chronic diseases, and the effects of aging. Researchers from Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center have released a study published in the September 12, 2006 issue of the Canadian Medical Association Journal that could help doctors identify patients whose driving ability will likely be impaired by dementia in the early stages. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Mark Rappaport, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychiatry in the Geriatric Psychiatry Division at the University of Toronto, Clinical Scientist at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, and Head of the Geriatric Mild to Moderate Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic at Sunnybrook, and one of the co-authors of this study. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What are some of the cognitive changes that accompany the progression from mild to moderate dementia?
So patients with mild to moderate dementia have difficulties with their memory, with their visuospatial skills, with their planning and their judgment. The transition is very gradual between mild and moderate, and there's no hard line that defines that that transition, but by the time someone has a moderate dementia, they're having substantial difficulties taking care of their activity, their what we call instrumental activities of daily living.
How difficult is it to detect dementia in its early stages for families and even for physicians?
Well, the detection of dementia is certainly quite challenging. 97% of very mild dementia is not recognized even by family physicians, and moderate, more mild to moderate dementia is also often missed.
Now, with regards to the driving issue, and how do people cope with the changes, especially with respect to driving ability? There was in the article, what I found very interesting was how family members may inadvertently assist the person who is deteriorating in ways that allow them to continue to function because they're dependent on them for specific lifestyle issues.
Absolutely. In our society, unfortunately, and you're in Ottawa, I'm in Toronto, I can speak for the system in Toronto, when someone gives up their license, there really aren't a lot of affordable, practical, available options for getting around to the grocery store and to social things that one needs to do. So that is a huge factor. So families would definitely play into that. The other, often the spouse has medical problems of their own that that limit their ability to drive.
There was one point made about a spouse who is dependent on her husband to drive, and she would direct him on the various occurrences and potential hazards on the road in order to keep him on track.
That's right. Well, we call that the co-pilot syndrome, and that's really is probably not the safest.
Okay.
It might work for experienced flight personnel, but I don't think it works for the average driver.
Now, what were some of the questions you had prior to developing your study? What was the body of evidence that led you to direct yourself to design this study?
Well, there were two things. Hopkins very recently published a study out of Queen's University where he made an estimate of the number of people with dementia who were on the roads. And that estimate was based on the prevalence of dementia as coded in the Canadian Study in Health and Aging, which is about 8% of people over the age of 65. So he took that number, and he, through mathematic formulas, he combined that with the fact that most seniors drive, and he projected that currently, at least in 2000, there were 34,000 people with dementia on the roads, and that projected to 2028, there'd be 100,000 Canadians with dementia driving on the roads. So that was one. That was a mathematical estimate of the numbers that would be out there. And another study that was published recently by Ducek from the University of Washington, from Washington University, she found that patients with dementia who are able to pass, the ones who are able to pass a road test, when they're tested 1 year later, only 40% of them still pass. And 2 years later, none of them still pass. So This is mild dementia. Most of it's Alzheimer's disease, and Alzheimer's disease is gradually progressive. And as it gradually progresses, the skills in driving become weaker, and the risk increases. So we took that information, and we thought, well, what's the reality? We had this study called the Canadian Outcome Study in Dementia that was collecting prospective data longitudinally for looking forward in time. They looked at about 900 patients with mild to moderate dementia living in the community across Canada. And my colleague, Dr. Nathan Herman, and I were very interested in, well, what's happening with the driving of these people? So the question that was asked in that large-scale, long, they were seen every 6 months for 3 years, the question that was asked for this particular study was, are you still driving? And I wasn't surprised that about a quarter of them, 28%, were still driving at baseline. But what really surprised me was that 2 years later, 50% of them are still driving. 3 years later, 20% of them are still driving. So with that figure, comparing that to what Ducek found with the on-road testing, where none of them passed 2 years later, and we have 50% of them on our road, this is alarming.
What were some of the factors that led to those to decide for themselves to stop driving? What triggered it for them versus those that just continued regardless?
Right. So one of the limitations of this study, though, is that we actually don't know why they stopped. Only in a small minority of less than 20% of them stopped because their license was revoked, and very few of them stopped because they felt they voluntarily wanted to stop or spouse did. So most of them, we don't know why they stopped. So that is going to be a limitation of the work that we did. But some of the factors that led them to stop driving, well, age was a predictor of stopping driving. But the biggest predictors were the severity of the cognitive impairment. That's not surprising. Mm-hmm. But what was really interesting and surprising to me was that behaviors, the abnormal behaviors that go along with dementia were strong predictors of driving cessation.
Now, what kind of behaviors? How would someone recognize that in say, a family member? What would trigger them to say something is really wrong?
Well, we actually looked at all the different behaviors, and of them, the biggest risk factor was hallucinations. So that caused almost a threefold increase in stopping driving. So patients who had auditory or visual hallucinations, you can imagine if you're behind the wheel and you're hearing voices or seeing things that could get in the way of accurate, that could substantially get in the way of accurate driving abilities. That was probably, and that's fairly easy to recognize. Mm-hmm. The patients would usually be talking about seeing or hearing things that just aren't there. That was the largest factor from a behavior perspective. What we also found really counterintuitive was that agitation and aggression. That's something that happens in about 20-30% of patients with dementia, usually in more severe stages than mild. Mm-hmm. But if you had mild dementia and were agitated and aggressive, you were less likely to stop driving.
It's almost like a stubbornness in some ways.
Potentially, I really don't understand how that could be. I mean, it could be that the doctors or their families are just uncomfortable confronting them.
That's true.
They need to stop driving. It's really, but that is frightening. The idea that of those who are still on the road, some of them are aggressive and agitated.
Wow.
I don't think, you know, that lends a whole new flavor to road rage. This is rage that's related to a disease of the brain where the brain is shrinking, and there's substantial agitation, and that could certainly pose a risk behind the wheel.
Now, my understanding is that you also looked at the types of assessments that could be used to determine driving competency. What were they, and how well did they correlate with the actual driving ability?
So that is another big weakness of the study. We did not look at all about competence of driving. We just looked at whether they were driving or not. So we didn't do any driving assessments.
Okay.
We didn't try to predict who was going to be a good driver or a bad driver. We just reported who the only question that we had here for the study was who is on the road, and what are some things that predicts who's on the road and who's not on the road.
So from this point now, what direction do you want to go in? Are you going to be expanding this now to answer that very question? What tools can be made available to objectively determine a person's competency to drive so that we are not inadvertently removing people from the road just on the basis of their age, but rather on their ability to drive just like anybody else.
Well, some colleagues who are actually in Ottawa from the Department of Geriatrics in Ottawa have formed this group that I'm a part of that's called CanDrive. And CanDrive is a research program that the whole aim is to detect unsafe driving in the doctor's office, to form a base of evidence where doctors could do a prescribed assessment that's very clear and that's very doable within a span of a very busy doctor's office, where the doctor could reliably and validly predict who is going to be safe or unsafe to drive. That is a long-term plan, and that is going to take a lot of research funding. It's going to take a lot of time to come up with that information, but doctors need that desperately at this point. That's certainly one area that we need to look at. I think another area that's fascinating that comes out of this study is, what about these behaviors? That's an area that I'm actively interested in as a research area as well.
And I guess as well, with this determination, if over the long term there is a mechanism or tool in place to help, there is, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, the need to be able to provide adequate alternatives for people so that they are not left sitting at home with a complete loss of independence, that there is some sort of support to allow them to transport themselves where they need to go.
And that's not just a good Samaritan issue. That is a very practical issue. When they've looked at patients who stop driving, even when they control for baseline functional status, what happens over time is that they stop going out of the house. They stop doing things. They get depressed. The levels of depression are much higher. There's about a 2.5 times reduction of activities outside the home, some of which include shopping.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that when you visit someone's house, they might have a cheese sandwich in the fridge and nothing else, this might be one of the consequences of taking away the driver's license. We desperately need some other options to help people get around, because driving is a privilege. It's not a right. It has to be in the context of driving safety.
Well, it would seem, though, if we took a long-term perspective and said, if we manage to identify those people who are at greatest risks of causing crashes, and the morbidity and the harm and the economic and social impact from that, and remove that out of that pool, the funds that would normally be going to take care for people under those circumstances could certainly help those people now removed from driving to use that to help them do exactly as you said, to help them be as independent as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, and the risk is not just of the senior driver who's involved in an accident.
It's everybody else.
It's everybody else. Young people on the roads, the pedestrians, and so forth.
Well, Dr. Rappaport, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the opportunity to discuss the study with us, and I hope to have you back on as your work continues to hear an update.
I'd also just like to add that the other problem that we have as doctors is that we, no matter what tools we have, the ultimate test of how a person does on the road is how they do on the road.
Right.
And on-road testing at this point, whether you're an older person or whether you have dementia, just does not exist. The government does not fund on-road testing anymore, and I think that is a huge problem. It's a problem for the older driver because of all the medical problems, but I think it's an even more it's a much greater problem for the driver with dementia, who is by definition at risk of dangerous driving, and who should definitely have a assessment of driving on the road. We need to somehow come up with access to for people to be able to afford this expensive on-road test, which will tell us how they're doing right now in driving. Are they safe to drive for the next 6 months, or should we be stopping them from driving right now?
Well, it's almost as if you would be able to have just as you have a requisition for a blood test or an imaging study, just to say, this is what I need you to do, because the medical evidence in the office illustrates to me that there may be an issue with regards to your driving. I can't 100% say that you cannot drive, but I would like an independent assessment done so that on the basis of that, we then can come to some sort of conclusion. Either it's going to say there are limitations to your driving, these are the restrictions that you have, or you just cannot drive.
Right. I like the analogy of the blood test because I think that's how accessible it should be for that to work.
Dr. Rapport, once again, I'd like to thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
All the best.